Daniel DiMartino Booth, CEO and Chief Strategist for QI Research. Welcome to the Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
I'm feeling more competent already. Thank you for having me and congratulations on this. I'm so excited for us.
Well, I'm very grateful for that, Danielle, and I'm also very grateful for you making some time for me, of course, today. We're speaking on November 19th in the afternoon here. The latest Fed minutes just dropped. Was there anything notable in them?
I think what the Fed minutes did was reiterate the hawkish stance of many on the committee. And the fact that these minutes hit within minutes of news that we're not going to get an October payrolls report at all, it couldn't have been better orchestrated by the hawks on the FOMC, because as the minutes hit, the odds of a December rate cut just melted away completely. Because the administration is now going to have the November payroll report come out on December 16th. They actually pushed that beyond the Fed meeting. So now Jay Powell's got the excuse he's been looking for. We do not have any data. We cannot see. We're flying blind. The fog's too thick, and we're just going to hold. By the way, Merry Christmas.
Well, Danielle, exactly in that, why are we not getting that data? I saw recently that we're also not getting an October jobs report. It was
At
canceled,
all.
as well as the September JOLTS report. Why would this be?
So actually, there is some justification, because we did just come through the longest government shutdown of all time. And one of the surveys asks you, were you employed? And it was a curious thing, because I saw in the media today, well, maybe somebody doesn't know if they were employed last month. And I'm like, well, I know if I was employed last month. These are usually things you can pinpoint, at least, whatever your checking account balance is reflecting this week. But the fact is, it would have been double the work for the statisticians to go back and say, what was the situation in October? What was the situation in November? And so what they're going to do effectively is roll whatever occurred in October into November and apparently say a prayer. But again, the modus operandi of the Trump administration right now is to cut rates. They just handed Powell a reason to not cut rates. So, interesting world we're living in right now.
Absolutely. Well,
I would not want to be Scott Bessent. I would not want to be Scott Bessent.
explain more about that.
I mean, you have to deal with the most impulsive president to ever grace the White House without an east wing now. So you would hate to be the person having to clean that up all the time.
Right.
And, have to go on Sunday morning news shows and say, well, that $2,000 tariff rebate, that's really going to come through, the one big beautiful bill. And Bessent's cognizant of the fact that these are acts of Congress. And lo and behold, as we record this just a few hours ago, the members of the GOP told Trump they were not on board with this tariff rebate check for $2,000. We remember what happened when we handed out money like candy. We got double-digit inflation just about. So the memories are too fresh of the CARES Act that Trump signed into law that ignited inflation, that was then, we poured more gasoline onto the flames with a second stimulus check and a third stimulus check. Stimulus checks, they create a very short spurt of activity. They give the economy a sugar high. And then you have to deal with, the whining, screaming kid who wants more sugar. And that's and so I applaud GOP members of Congress. I've never said that, or any member of Congress, but at least they see what recent history is, and we don't need to give people $2,000. Bessent was very diplomatic. He said, well, we can hope that if we did manage to push it through Congress, that everybody would save that $2,000. And I said, well, isn't that adorable? Because that's what Americans do when you give them cash. They save every penny. Not really. So,
Especially with credit card rates where they are, or delinquency rates where they are, auto loans where they are.
yeah, I mean, yeah, TransUnion just came out with a report this afternoon on October delinquency rates. I mean, speaking of those stimulus checks, if you look at 2021 and 2022, the vintages of credit card loans from those years, those delinquency rates are higher than any other year all the way back to 2019, because people, we gave people money and then they spent the money and then they wanted more stuff. So they just put it on credit.
Well, I want to stick with the data for a little bit right here, Danielle. And I'm getting to a point here. So we've also seen all of these layoff announcements coming out of big corporations. For example, I saw UPS laying off 48,000 people going into the holidays, Amazon 14,000, Intel 20,000. Some companies are pointing towards AI as taking over jobs, but could it instead be of having that cover of AI that the economy is just that weak that they can use this boogeyman of AI when it's actually aggregate demand instead?
So you know what? You should have Craig Fuller on from FreightWaves. He would be a great guest. And he will tell you that the transportation sector, that freight in America right now is telling you that we are in a deep recession.
And that was one of the tells at the beginning of COVID, right?
It was. Mm-hmm. It was. But there are also, beyond the U.S. being in recession, and the fact that, as you said, October layoff announcements came in at a 15-year high. And then, you know, as a little punctuation point after that, Verizon said, I'll see your 14,000 Amazon and I'll give you 15,000 layoffs. Companies also, during COVID, did what American consumers did. They extrapolated. They extrapolated this extraordinary level of demand that was initially fueled by what we're now $16.5 trillion since the pandemic hit of government debt growth. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of money to throw at people to spend. But companies also overhired. So right now we have this kind of toxic mix. We're at this intersection of companies right-sizing their workforces at the same time as the U.S. economy is in recession. So they're making these big cuts. And by the way, the Bureau of Labor Statistics years ago got rid of the mass layoff report. So it doesn't have to go into anything aggregate. That's why Challenger Gray and Christmas data is used. That's why Challenger Gray and Christmas exists, because the government canceled that data set. You used to be able to follow mass layoff announcements through statistical agencies. I'm having a bad day with pronunciation, just fair warning. But in any event, the Fed's still going to say that they're flying blind. They're going to ignore ADP's weekly rolling 4 weeks that show that job losses in the net began in mid-October. They're just going to look right past it. Mm-hmm.
The reason I wanted to bring all of those data points up, Danielle, is that I want to understand this from your perspective, from your time at the Fed. Did you ever see times where data was, let's say, massaged or managed in a particular way in order to serve a particular purpose?
So this is in FedUp, but FedUp is almost 10 years old, which means that the book is aged, but I haven't. But there's a scene in FedUp where, may he rest in peace, Stanley Fisher. It was his very first FOMC meeting. He'd been brought in to be vice chair of the Fed. Janet Yellen was in charge, and they were worried that she would break something in the financial markets. So Stanley Fisher came out of retirement in Israel. He was called the godfather of central bankers. You know, if Ben Bernanke or if Mario Draghi was having an existential crisis in the middle of the night, they'd call Stan Fisher and say, you know, what do I do? So he comes out of retirement to be vice chair of the Fed. His very first FOMC meeting, he said, my children, they live their lives based on headline CPI. Most Americans, they use headline CPI because it reflects things they have to buy. Mm-hmm. They don't look at core CPI because they still have to buy food and gasoline. So why isn't the Fed using a more realistic inflation target as opposed to one that only exists in theory? And some, you know, this is a scene in FedUp, but some, you know, brave Fed staffer in the back of the room raised their hand and said, well, if we used real inflation, we wouldn't have the cover to continue with quantitative easing or zero interest rate policy, at which point Jim Bullard, being the hot dog who he is, decided he was going to be cute. And he said, well, let me understand this, right? This is how we make monetary policy: garbage in, garbage out. And that's basically what it was. And the Fed had a great opportunity with this government shutdown to say, we are going to be an institution going forward that's going to use more real-time data. We're not going to rely exclusively on government data going forward. And we've learned our lesson. So we're going to incorporate more alternatives into our monetary policy making framework. And instead, we just see Fed funds futures for December rate cut collapse because the Fed's chosen to say that the fog has gotten thicker because we're not going to have an October or before we meet in December, a November non-farm payrolls report. So they're just digging in their heels. But again, it's always data is used by the Fed as a weapon of mass destruction to serve their needs and nothing more than that. And that was what I saw when I was on the inside. And it sure as hell what I'm seeing today on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, you recently also said that the Fed is basically under unprecedented attack. Do you think that this is because it's become more politicized than it has ever been in the past, than it should be or has ever been?
So, well, this all started with Alan Greenspan. It's just the political aspect was much more gentlemanly. It was understood. It was a wink. It was a nod. It was, oh, look, the stock market is down. We'll ease policy. But it was never on the front page of the New York Post. So, and that's where it is today. Today, it's very public. But the only thing that's changed is how splashy the headlines are, because you've got a showman in the White House. But the Fed brought this upon themselves. And now in this particular chapter, not only are they under unprecedented attack by the current administration, they're also politicized to a greater extent than they've ever been with their policymaking. So, you know, if I had to sum it up, I think the difference between the Fed being politicized in prior chapters, starting with Alan Greenspan, and today is that there's the public aspect of the Fed being under attack in a very splashy way. At the same time, the Fed is no longer pretending that it's acting in the public good. Mm-hmm. It's as overtly political in its monetary policy making today as the administration is in attacking the Federal Reserve as an institution. And I think that this will go down as one of the darkest and most politicized chapters of the Fed. If we could ever get decent leadership in this country and in Congress, I think that there would be very much grounds to stand on to revisit the Federal Reserve Act and make the Fed become an accountable institution going forward, because they're abusing their power.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any front runners for taking over this, at this point, this horrible job that Powell is finishing up in May?
Well, I would like to think it's going to be Christopher Waller. Kevin Warsh made a very political public appeal in the Wall Street Journal just a few days ago. Mm-hmm. But I think Bessent would be wise to rely on a very level-headed, very non-political member of the Fed, Christopher Waller, who just after he was appointed as a governor came out and said in his very first public interview on Bloomberg TV, he said, you know, the housing market's on fire. The Fed should be out of the quantitative easing game with mortgage-backed securities. Mm-hmm. You know, Waller has been a voice of reason for many, many years, and I think that he would certainly be the best choice. He stood behind Chair Powell at the September meeting, because Stephen Miron's appointment as a Fed governor was an affront to the Fed's independence. Mm-hmm. But immediately after that meeting, he came out and said, we still have justification for a rate cut going forward into October, subsequent to this meeting, as he's been saying in the last few days. There is still justification. We see from other data indicators that the labor market is weakening. So he is maintaining his voice of independence, despite so many on the Fed kind of lining up behind Powell and talking about the inflation boogeyman that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Keeping on this theme of the most politicized and maybe dark chapter in the Fed's history, I did an interview about a month ago where the gentleman laid out his thoughts on how President Trump could actually be trying to stack the Fed Reserve Bank presidents and chair with those that would be sympathetic to him, and how he thinks that monetary policy should operate and drop rates to his preferred targets. is the reality of that being achieved far more complicated, or is that, you know, something that you see happening here?
It's very much the former. It's far more complicated than that because, at the risk of repeating myself, Christopher Waller is in charge of the committee to vet all 12 Federal Reserve District Bank presidents' reappointment at the end of February of 2026. And he is level-headed. Mm-hmm. Raphael Bostic, lovely man, Atlanta Fed, one too many violations of insider trading. He announced his resignation from the Atlanta Fed. He's going to be leaving. I think that that was probably a reflection of the fact that it's not okay to bend the rules and be caught more than once doing insider trading. I think that's a reflection of Waller. We learned that Adriana Kugler, who mysteriously and abruptly left the Federal Reserve Board, opening a space for Stephen Miron. Mm-hmm. We learned that she too had one too many insider trading violations. I go back to the fact that if the gentleman behind this is gently saying, this is not how this institution should operate. We, unlike Congress, we do not operate above the law. It's a matter of public record that Christopher Waller is in charge of all 12 appointments. Mm-hmm. So I don't see it as coincidence, but I don't think by the same token that Donald Trump is going to be able to stack the Fed.
Right. Danielle, I keep bringing up the repo rate spike that we saw recently on the show here. Do you think that this signals a need for the Fed to move back to QE and an expansion of the balance sheet in order to give the banks the liquidity they need to keep functioning under their current paradigm?
Well, the irony here is that you've got trillions and trillions of dollars that are locked up in the biggest banks that are not providing liquidity to the system, and that liquidity to the non-banking sector, which is bigger than the conventional banking sector, is drying up. And that mismatch, you know, the Fed does not need to be paying interest on excess reserves. They need for the money that's in the big banks to be flowing out into the economy. Mm-hmm. But as long as the big banks are incentivized to either get paid interest on excess reserves or are penalized in some way, shape, or form for extending that liquidity, there's going to be pressure on the Fed to provide liquidity to the system, even if it's a not QE situation where it's just overnight funding that the Fed is providing, as we saw during the first not QE episode. And it very much is going to become problematic. I understand that the spike then dissipated, but we've got the end of November, and boy, we've got December 31st coming up, which is the biggest liquidity date on the calendar. And the Fed has basically raised the white flag and said, we cannot get banks to borrow from the standing repo facility, which is supposed to be the release valve. And if they can't do that, and if they continue accessing funding in the repo market at prohibitively high rates, we're going to have a liquidity crisis again. There's no two ways about it.
Does QE end up more fixing liquidity, or does it more fix sentiment instead?
Initially, QE fixes liquidity. Mm-hmm. Initially, it's the Band-Aid.
Okay.
It's when we got to the end of 2019. It's the last time we saw jobless claims at the levels that they're at today. It's the last time the U.S. economy was in a regular recession, falling into a regular recession. At that point, the Fed was desperate to shift from just being a provider of liquidity to preventing insolvency. Mm-hmm. And when you cross that line, that's when you need actual QE, balance sheet expansion, going out, buying coupons. And that was where we were in 2019. And the Fed was desperate for an excuse to launch full-blown QE. And in February 2020, it got its excuse. It got a global pandemic.
Right.
And put $3 trillion on the balance sheet in very short order. Mm-hmm.
Is much of this a moot point anyway, as a reaction to the market and the economy because of the magnitude of the deflationary forces that are already present and accelerating?
Yes, it's a moot point. I mean, again, As my good friend George Goncalves says, the longer the Fed knows it needs to be easing and it's not, the more it's going to have to play catch up when it finally does take action. If it's forestalling and forestalling and forestalling, it's creating a larger balloon payment, if you will, when whatever the liquidity event is that happens, happens. And right now, unfortunately, we have, you know, we have a situation where I'm staring at the Bitcoin price, but we have a situation where overvaluation in the equity markets was the primary issue in 99, 2000. And in 07, 08, it was over leverage. But right now we have both of them. So we don't know what the Fed's reaction function is going to look like, because we've never had these types of dueling bubbles, if you will, at the same time.
So all of this summarized, you know, we've talked about all of the bad. Danielle, what do you see as the most important steps for Americans or the average American to take right now to protect themselves and their savings?
Well, I think you have to have a way of either saying, I'm young enough to ride this through, whatever it is, or you have to have income protection of some kind, whether it's owning a huge oil company that's never cut its dividend so that you can look the other way if its stock price melts down like it did in 2009, just hold on to it, collect the dividend, and eventually it recovers. But you have to be hedged in some way. And that's what the VIX index is telling us. When the VIX goes above 20 and stays above 20, the VIX is telling you, you better be hedged. And right now, being hedged for a tail event is more expensive than it's been in a very long time. Or if you prefer, Oracle credit default swaps on its debt, they've gone through the roof. People always say, I didn't see it coming. But there's always telltale signs.
I think those telltale signs have never been more difficult to sort through and difficult to really wrap your arms around the magnitude of than this time that we've currently been through. But
so my buddy Peter Buchvar boiled it down beautifully. All he did was take the debt to equity ratios of the Mag 7 12 months ago and today. And it was really simple to see. There was no more gray area. It wasn't Jay Powell's paralyzing fog. It was just pretty damn apparent that these gigantic companies and our fate relies on them, and the fate of the free world and the biggest economy in the nation relies on the top 10% keeping their stock market gains. It's just a much more leveraged bet 12 months later than it was a year ago. And that is not hard to parse.
Absolutely. Danielle, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. For those that want to see more of Danielle's work, of course, that's all available at quillintelligence.com, at DMartino Booth on X, QIResearch.com, and of course, DMartinoBooth.substack.com. Danielle, thanks so much.
You did that better than I could have. Thanks much. I look forward to next time.
Me too. Thank you.